The Bradshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Bradshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. It is me, Aisha, in the studio again with you this week. And alongside me, I have Matt Boothman.
Good evening.
And Vicky Weston.
Good evening, all.
Vicky, you haven't been in the studio for a while.
For ages.
I know. We're very excited.
It's like light outside.
I know.
This is a big deal, people.
Things have changed since you've been away.
I know. There's all kinds of changes in the studio as well. It's very exciting.
Yes. So this week on the show, we are dedicating a lot of it to talk about Blackshaw's upcoming production of Black Shuck, which is a part of the WAF Festival, which is beginning on the 6th of May, which you probably will have heard because it is a big Wandsworth deal and people on this station will be talking about it a lot, I feel. We're also going to be hearing from Ellie, the director, and the two cast members of Black Shuck, as well as Duncan Hands, who is the writer. And Vicky is going to be doing not an arts thing. We've finally got you in the studio. And you're not doing an arts thing.
Well, I suppose it's like sort of an arts thing in that it's about an arts thing, but it's a thing I actually did, so it's slightly different to
it's
usual.
Like an amalgamation of
when we do a review and an arts thing.
Yeah.
I've cleverly spliced the two together to save on time.
Yeah, you've done a very good job.
Thank you very much.
But as you know, the first thing that we always do on the show is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Got all my promos back this week, Matt.
Yeah, happy? I'm excited, yes.
Yeah, good, you should be.
Feels legitimate.
What are you talking about this week?
Let's talk about Eye in the Sky.
Yes.
Which we've been saying we're going to do a compare and contrast.
I forgot about this.
We're going to do an academic compare and contrast of drone warfare portrayals in the media between London Has Fallen and Eye in the Sky.
Ah, yeah. This is good. I like it.
Basically, I saw this film as a reaction to London Has Fallen. Mm-hmm. I think it was trailed before London Has Fallen, and I went afterwards, oh, I wish I'd been watching that instead.
I'm so sorry.
So in London Has Fallen, basically drone strikes are like the gotcha button that the president gets to press to take out the bad guys as a big gotcha at the end. Whereas here in Eye in the Sky, a drone strike is a very sort of considered, all options weighed up, an incredibly bureaucratic process.
Mm-hmm.
So like the norm in a war movie, or in sort of the classical canon of war movies, is that the bureaucracy is sort of generally shown as like the obstacle to heroism. So like the bureaucrats in their tents or back in, you know, command headquarters saying, no, you can't go and do that because bureaucracy.
You can't handle the truth,
yeah, exactly.
Et cetera.
Like, you know, the soldiers on the front line are the ones going, no, we know what we should be doing and we're going to be the heroes and screw bureaucracy. Whereas the bureaucracy here is almost the hero, and I was sitting through kind of hope, willing this to be a war movie in which not a single shot is fired, and that's the kind of the attitude that it gives you. Mm-hmm. Is that you're actually it creates a situation where maybe the best outcome is for nothing to happen, which is an odd place to be in, like in a drama.
Yeah. I would say that's like the main tenet of drama is not create a situation where the ideal outcome would be nothing happens.
Yeah. Like the essence of drama is
conflict. No one's teaching you that. Like, yeah, the essence of all good drama is conflict. That's like the first thing you learn when you go to playwriting school.
Yeah. So in Eye in the Sky, basically there's a mission. It's taking place in Kenya, or rather like the stuff on the ground is taking place in Kenya. There are some people who've joined what is basically the movie's version of the Islamic State, a couple of UK and US citizens who the various militaries are attempting to capture back so that they can kind of interrogate them, and they've got a drone in the sky over Kenya as their eye in the sky. But the terms of engagement change, first of all, when they discover that the house where these people they're surveilling are has some suicide vests in it, turning this basically from a capture mission into a do we kill these people mission. And then it's further complicated by little Kenyan girl from the house next door, whose name is Alia, setting up a stall to sell bread on the edge of the house that they are considering blowing up. Mm. And what follows is basically the world's most tense Skype call between Helen Mirren in a base in the UK and Alan Rickman and some politicians and other people in the cabinet office, and a pair of drone operators in a base in Nevada, and a visual analysis person whose job is to look at the footage and say, yes, that's definitely the person that we're looking for, who's in some other bit of America. And like all these people trying to make a call, mm-hmm. or in the case of a lot of them, trying their very best not to make a call. There's a lot of talk of, I think we should refer up, meaning let's kick the buck further up the chain of command until mm-hmm. we find somebody who's willing to make a decision. and so it's not just a sort of a very simple weighing the scales kind of decision. It's not a kind of good on one side, bad on the other side. Like, what kind of decision do we make? The movie shows that there are so many factors in play here. There's the fact that this is a friendly country that they're considering dropping a bomb on. Mm-hmm. The fact that there are US and UK citizens involved. The fact just the personalities of all the various different people involved in the decision, and the fact that some of them have got axes to grind. Like, Helen Mirren has been pursuing these people for X number of months and doesn't want to lose what she sees as her one opportunity to get them. And obviously the politicians are all very concerned about the PR and the optics of any decision that they make. And obviously morality comes into it as well.
Yeah.
Especially sort of for the drone pilots themselves sitting in their little shack on their base in Nevada, mm-hmm. because they're the ones who are ultimately going to be pulling the trigger if that happens. Although the movie does show the kind of the disconnect between their morality, but the thing happening on the ground, there's a huge long delay between clicking the trigger and anything actually happening.
Yeah, so like, are they controlling a drone in Kenya from Nevada?
Yes.
Yeah, that's how it works.
That makes no sense to me. Yeah.
That's how it works.
I'm picturing the drone being like tiny, like the size of a brick.
No, it's huge.
I feel like I'm misinformed about drones.
I think it's because it's actually kind of frightening to think about the realities of what's actually what we're actually capable of now.
So like the size of a plane?
It's not quite the size of a plane. Like, they're not the little quadcopters that you see people flying around the park. They are plane-shaped.
Sure.
And they're sort of, or actually,
but they don't need to hold a person.
Yeah, more glider-shaped.
Right.
But they're smaller than mm-hmm. a plane, but they are still quite sizable. And obviously, they're big enough and heavy enough to carry missiles and enough fuel to stay in the air for however long.
Ooh, I don't like it.
Yeah, they're scary things.
This is why I haven't thought about it.
Yeah,
guys.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
I don't like unmanned aircraft.
Yeah. The idea of taking the human element out of warfare is really it's just really frightening.
Yeah, removing it to Nevada.
And this movie does definitely, it shows that there is the potential when this is what warfare is, for it to be reduced to a numbers game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For it to just be somebody runs some numbers through a computer and runs a simulation and says there is a 65% chance of fatal injury to X number of civilians, and it just becomes that number of civilians is less than the number of civilians a suicide bomber should kill, so therefore we should go for it.
Yeah, it all evens out in the
but
end.
It show by having that number of people involved in the decision process, obviously it slows everything down, which ironically makes the movie tenser.
Yep.
They're all on the clock here.
Yeah.
But also it means that the human element is there.
Yeah,
there
is disconnect, discussion.
But yeah, there is a discussion, and practically everybody in that chain of command seems to have the ability to say, no, stop, I want more information.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is a good thing. Like, that's actually a good thing in terms of, you know, the way you would want decisions being made about the taking of human life.
Yeah.
More discussions about the why you would do it is better than somebody who's potentially a trigger happy individual based on the ground taking action without really thinking it through.
Interestingly, the one of the conclusions it seems to come to about the sort of passing the buck back up the chain is that basically just the buck keeps going until it hits somebody who is kind of unconcerned enough to make a snap decision and who doesn't really want to give that consideration.
Who has got other things to do on their plate and they're like, I need to make a decision and get this off of my plate.
Or is just slightly less concerned about the loss of human life than another person.
Just more of an... Dick, really.
And while all of this is going on over the world's tensest Skype conversation, obviously the only person who is oblivious to all of this is the little girl, who is the centre of the discussion. Who's it keeps going back to her and making it very clear that, you know, all her fate is hanging in the balance, and she has absolutely no idea.
Yeah,
she's in a war zone without knowing she's in a war zone.
And like the only so it's the people on the ground at the sharp end in the firing line. Her and Barkhad Abdi's character, the guy who sort of was plucked from obscurity in Captain Phillips.
He's so good.
He is great.
Such a good actor.
And he's like the man on the ground who's in for like the close surveillance. And so he's the only one really with any ability to influence things right there in the zone. Mm-hmm. But of course, that means that being at the sharp end, he doesn't have the big picture. So he doesn't really have all the information to make a decision. So it's, you know, it means that it's all the Western people in their safe offices are making the decisions, while the Kenyan people are left there sort of waiting to take the brunt of whatever decision ends up being made.
Oh dear.
Yeah. So I don't know whether this is a more or less realistic portrayal of drone warfare than, say, London Has Fallen.
Sure.
Obviously, I'm not in the military, so I don't know whether maybe the president could just go, send a drone, as they do in London Has Fallen, or whether it's more like this. Mm-hmm. I'd rather drone warfare wasn't really a thing, but if it has to be a thing, then I hope it's like it's portrayed in this movie and not like in London Has Fallen.
Yeah. I think, I would agree with you on that. And I feel like this probably is slightly more moralistic than London Has Fallen. How does it weigh up in terms of, I think you and I both found London Has Fallen quite racist.
Yes.
This one? Racist or not racist?
I did not find it racist.
Brilliant. No. That's what we want, guys. Yeah. Films that aren't racist.
Here we go. Yeah. Here we go, guys. Let's make films that aren't racist.
Yeah. Also, more men than women in it, but
slightly better
women
balance.
In various different positions of power. Helen Mirren's character has a lot of say, and there's another female character in the cabinet office who is very much like the moral voice in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. I can't even remember if there was any females in London as well. Was there?
Gemma Arterton was in it.
Okay,
was she the eye candy?
She doesn't really do anything.
Yeah, she's the eye candy.
Yeah,
guys, she's the eye candy. She doesn't do anything. I've got a question about Helen Mirren's character.
Okay,
Is she like the voice of is she the voice of compassion, or is she like, let's go?
She is the most gung-ho.
I love it.
Thing.
Yeah, it's good. Because I've been finding that when you do put like good, strong women in films, they then end up being like the de facto voice of, you know, compassion, or they're like the motherly one who's like, no, we can't do that. Or they make them the hero. And I'm like, it's great that they're the hero in the situation. Like, I am so all for more female heroes, but I kind of also want to see more female anti-heroes and women who are flawed and real and have
asses.
You know, and that just because she's a woman doesn't mean she's automatically like, save the child, we've got to save the child. She's
my
like,
motherly
no.
instinct is screaming to save
the
child,
because it's just not realistic. Mm. And the idea that she would be the one who's like, actually no, I'm on a mission here and I want this done, it's good.
I want to fulfill
a good thing.
An aspect of my career, please.
Yeah, I'm like, you go, Helen. Thing.
Her main face-to-face antagonist in the movie is a lawyer. And you actually find yourself rooting for, or I did anyway, rooting for the lawyer.
That is a,
not usual in a movie.
Yes, Helen, yes. I feel like she's nailed it. I haven't seen the film, but I feel like she's absolutely killed it.
She
and
is
I'm very happy.
Like, it's more of an ensemble piece than the marketing suggests. Like, they're marketing it as she is the main character and this is about her conflict and her struggle. It's really not. She's one piece in a massive ensemble, and that's what it's about. Like, the process is almost the star of the movie.
What is the use? So you say that it's a lot over Skype. What is the use of like technology like in like filmically? Because I find when you're trying to portray people over Skype in films, it can come across as a bit tacky and a bit like, oh yes, this is definitely a Skype call, guys. We need to. Where's the Skype logo?
Oh well, it's I'm using Skype as as a generic.
There's just some kind of video conference situation.
It didn't get in the way for me. Like it is a lot of people talking to screens, but that is.
The reality.
That is how it is. Like, that was almost saying, like, I don't know whether this is how it really works. That was almost the least believable bit for me, is that they're all on these video calls constantly and none of them ever drop.
Yes, I was going to say, if it was at my work, it would be every 5 minutes you'd be like, guys, can you just turn off your video a second because your bandwidth isn't quite good enough and the sound's coming through all tinny? Like,
Helen Mirren's frozen.
Yeah, oh, just give her a minute. Oh, she's dropped off. She'll be back again in a minute. That would be,
can you imagine how long in reality it takes to make, like, I mean, that's how long is the film? Like, what, nearly 2 hours?
About that.
Is it probably almost in real time? Is that
is pretty much the idea, yeah.
Oh, yeah, with the kind of internet that we have, I feel like that would take at least four real life, not
like
movie
we've
life.
Got pretty good technology at work for that kind of thing, but I would say it would still be problematic.
Yeah.
Okay, so it seems like it was slightly realistic and sometimes slightly unrealistic.
but more realistic than London Has Fallen, which wasn't a very high bar to me.
No.
Well, anything would be, yeah.
Also, I don't know whether this was Alan Rickman's last film, but it does have a little in memory of, at the end.
So emotional.
I believe it is. I think I read somewhere that it was, but maybe there's stuff that he did.
It's a good one.
I mean,
he spends the whole thing sort of in full military uniform, tapping away at a laptop in the cabinet office, which is really... you know, again, this is what war is like now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everyone's behind a desk.
But yeah, it's still a good performance from him.
Yeah.
And from everyone.
Good to know.
Fantastic. Thank you, Matt. Do you know what you're doing in a fortnight?
Yes, I will be doing Captain America Civil War.
Oh yeah, nice. I saw them walk in the red carpet.
I'm going to see that next weekend, I think. So,
AKA everybody in all the Marvel movies so far gets together and has a fight, and I have feelings about it.
Yeah, I saw some red carpet shots from them all doing that in America. It was on E or something, and it looked fun. And then Robert Downey started talking, and I was like, "Why are you talking like that? Is that his actual voice?"
Yep.
What is that about?
Yeah, he should be Tony Stark all the time, shouldn't he?
Yeah.
Like, just be Tony
He's
Stark.
He's got a really
Downey
funny
Jr.
little voice that doesn't fit his face.
He needs
face.
To just be Tony Stark all the time. Yeah, because fighting in superhero movies, i.e. Batman v Superman, not impressed by that. So War's got a lot of work to do here to convince me that it's worth seeing a movie where all your favourite heroes have a big fight and don't just sit down like big kids and use their big boy words to have a conversation about it instead.
Okay, we are looking forward to that one. Thank you, Matt. Now on the show, we are going to hear a interview. The lovely Leslie Strachan, who you hear on Wandsworth Radio, who is the arts correspondent, she went along to a rehearsal for Black Shark, and she spoke with Ellie and Alex and Rachel. And here it is.
So we're here down at rehearsal room at Battersea Arts Centre, but I'm with Blackshaw Arts. Ellie, the director, and two actors, Alex and Rachel. I've interrupted proceedings today, a bit of lunging I saw. So firstly, Ellie, just give us a quick 3-seconder.
Three seconds, come on, there's the
Blackshuck, whatever is that name all about?
Oh, the name is in reference to the legend of a shaggy black dog that lives and roams the areas of Norfolk coastline. So that's where the name comes from.
Right.
And that's where the play is set, on the Norfolk coastline. The play is about two inept smugglers who are smuggling for the first time. And it's the two of them and their conversation while they await the shipment.
Okay, so this is going to go out at the Wandsworth Fringe. Now, why are us Londoners, why are we going to come and see a play about a shaggy dog story on the Norfolk coastline?
Because it's very funny. It's comedy meets horror. It's an hour long. It's above a pub. It's new writing, which is always exciting to see. And it is a very tight, funny piece.
Okay, so let's ask Rachel and Alex... how funny is this play?
Oh, this is hilarious.
This is the funniest play I've ever been in, certainly, and I've been in a lot of funny plays.
Funny ha-ha or funny ugh.
Well, that's up to the audience, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you.
And me. And my performance, yes. Especially.
Absolutely. It is very funny. I think there's a lot of elements of kind of the comedy double act of sort of the straight guy and the
idiot.
Funny guy and the idiot. Yeah, yeah, Alex being the idiot. Which is really, really
in the
funny.
Play.
Oh, no, no. That stretches through life. So, yeah, no, it's very fun. I mean, there's some really great comedy moments, some really lovely lines, some very funny
physical
comedy, absolutely, which is being brought out today, certainly. Alex?
I think it's... why people should come and see it is, as Ellie said, it's new writing, and more importantly, it's good new writing, which I think puts a lot of people off sometimes when they hear it. They're like, new writing, oh, it could be a bit dodgy, and in this case, no, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting, it's nice and short, it allows people to come along, they can go to the pub, they can go above the pub and see some theatre, then have the rest of their evening free, which is a nice sort of, it's a nice precursor to the rest of their evening. So yeah, come along and see it, if only for that.
So the same goes for you as well, obviously. Is this why you only audition for one-hour shows? So you can get down the pub very quickly.
Absolutely,
afterwards?
Yes.
I don't want to speak for Rachel. She's just done that. Obviously, as a performer, I like to see it as an interesting and difficult way of bringing out the character. But yeah, I mean, getting down to the pub is quite important. I don't want to prevaricate too much around that, though.
No.
I just have.
Mm. And what about Norfolk accents? Do these feature?
No, luckily, because it's actually quite a difficult accent
to do. A Norfolk accent is
a
really
quite
tricky
particular
accent to do, yeah. I spent a lot of my childhood in Norfolk on holiday, and I would never try and do the accent. But thankfully, these two characters are actually from London.
Mm.
This is a modern play, so
yeah.
This isn't. We aren't sort of smugglers in the 16th century. We are smugglers in very much the 21st century. And we're from the East End, so we've got, we hope, very good, effective East End accents.
London accents, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You do get a little showcase of the Norfolk accent from a character who does not appear live. We've got a voice-only performance with a genuine Norfolk accent, and it's actually a cameo by the writer.
And he's from Norfolk?
He is from Norfolk.
There we are.
So you do get a little taster of the Norfolk tones.
Song.
Yeah.
Do we get an appearance of the Shaggy Dog?
Well, that is up to you to interpret, really.
Mm.
The characters encounter something, but we leave it to the imagination of the audience to decide a little bit whether there's any truth behind the legend.
Okay, now Blackshaw's known for its new writing. How did this play make the grade? What was the process?
Well, we, as people who know us will know, we run regular new writing nights and have done for the last 6 years. And Duncan Hands, the writer of Blackshuck, submitted some of his work for one of these new writing nights. It wasn't actually this piece, it was something completely different. But when it comes around to time for the Wandsworth Arts Fringe, we contact writers that we've had contact with and enjoyed their work and enjoyed working with them, and give them a brief. And Duncan answered our call.
And you guys, the audition process?
The audition process was fairly straightforward. We applied. We got an audition. We went to audition and just had to, like, I think you're Ellie, this is, I'm pointing at, wanted to sort of try out all of the different pairings, because it's just two people. It's like we had a lot of actresses, a lot of actors, and then you just mix them up.
Mm.
So it was nice to audition with a number of different people rather than just like one or two.
Yeah.
Or just yourself.
And aside from the story, what attracted you to the characters that you're playing? Is there any sort of autobiographical stuff going on?
I am a massive drug smuggler. probably shouldn't say that. No. To be honest, I mean, for me, it's very much, it's kind of a break. A recent work that I've done has involved quite serious work. Lovely work. It's kind of nice for me to sort of do something which is a bit more comedy now. Just sort of a bit of a break from that.
And so that was great, and I really enjoy it. And I like doing an accent. Mm. I quite enjoy that too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, and I don't know. I think it's, yeah, it's kind of good. I'm going to repeat myself.
There aren't a lot of parallels to draw between your character, Martha, and you, really, are there, in terms of life experience?
Well, there aren't a lot.
I don't think so.
Well, Ellie, you don't know many things about me.
I think we should really get into this.
We really don't want to. No. There aren't many parallels at all, no. We wear the same clothes. It's basically what it is.
And are roughly the same size.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Alex, what about you?
Not too similar, I think, but in terms of doing it, I just enjoy playing silly characters who I like, again, the same as Rachel, I like playing comedic roles. I get a lot of enjoyment from that. So doing that is always great fun. Performing with Rachel, though I wouldn't say it to her face, is great fun. Just doing more comedy is always a bonus.
And obviously wearing a T-shirt with Batman on for rehearsals probably is an indicator of your approach to the piece.
I have always considered myself a strident supporter of justice and vigilantism, which is one of the themes that is integral rather to this play. And I think
I think we're getting a good idea as to what I have to work with.
Yeah.
Really.
Fundamentally.
Is what we're
a Batman wannabe. I did suggest wearing a cape during rehearsals, but that was turned down.
Yeah.
Sure, annoyingly.
Even for a 16th century smuggler, I don't think that was in the makeup.
I also wanted a tricorn hat, but that was disallowed.
Now you're going for pole dark. And you ain't nowhere.
I'm not allowed.
I feel like I wouldn't have cast Alex for pole dark.
What are you saying?
Not quite the right look.
I've handled a scythe once.
So that interview descended into chaos quite quickly.
Standard practice for a Blackshaw situation.
Not anything against the lovely Leslie, who is a fantastic interviewer, but more the cast of Black Shark, I would say. I'm not going to put Ellie in the...
Yeah, I would say Rachel and Alex are capable of behaving themselves, but that's what we like about them.
Exactly. If you want to come and see Black Shark, it is on at the Bedford in Balham as a part of WAF. We'll give you all the dates towards the end of the show. The first thing now that is coming up is Arts Thing / Vicky's Reviewing a Thing.
Yep.
And that thing is The Maids.
Yes, that's right. On Thursday, me and Ellie, long-time presenter of the, of course, esteemed Blackshaw Arts Hour, went to see The Maids, an original play by Jean Genet in French, which was first performed in the 1940s, but has subsequently been revived a couple of times, but most recently by the Jamie Lloyd Theatre Company at the Trafalgar Studios. It's still on. It's excellent. You can get incredibly good value for money, very, very cheap front row seats, if you don't mind there being a bit of a pillar in the way. I totally recommend it, because being 2 feet away from Uzo Aduba of Orange is the New Black fame is totally worth not being able to see some of it.
Did you say cheap? Because I looked at them, they looked really expensive.
£29.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, we sat in the front row for £29. Can strongly recommend that. Yeah.
That's a great deal.
Yeah. And I got the tickets quite a while ago, but I had a look and there are still some available.
I looked before and they are.
So I strongly recommend going to see it. It is pretty racy, and there is a huge amount of swearing in it, which I'll go into in a moment as being one of the reasons why I really enjoyed it. So a couple of the reasons why I think it was excellent. Firstly, just stellar performances, really, from all three actresses. It's not often you go and see a play that's just three women being awesome on stage. This is one of those occasions, and it's one of those plays that kind of allows for some real like breadth and depth of performance of three different kinds. So that was really, really good. Zoe Ashton and Laura Carmichael, who are also famous for being on the telly. Zoe Ashton most famous for her completely nutso performance of Vod in Fresh Meat, which is a Channel 4 comedy, was absolutely sublime in the whole production. She is an incredible live performer. She's just mesmerizing, quite frankly. And Laura Carmichael is most famous for being Lady Edith from Downton Abbey, and she was very, very good as well, although she's not on stage for very long in the character that she was playing. So it was a very... the word I've been using, or the phrase I've been using to describe it, it has this kind of like slightly pink and sticky body glitter kind of tackiness about it, which actually works really, really well. And the whole premise of the play is that these two maids, played by Uzo and by Zoe, are kind of abused in a psychological way by their mistress. And they, when she's out for the day, they dress up as her and they kind of perform these bizarre, like, sadomasochistic rituals that end up with her dying at the end. But one of them is playing her the whole time. So they're kind of caricaturing her. And then one of them kills mistress while they're dressed up as her. So it's kind of, it's very bizarre, very frantic. It's got a kind of psychological thriller feel to it. And then they kind of clean up for her to arrive back home, and then some other things are revealed about things that they've done and the fact that actually they have actually tried to kill her on a couple of occasions and are plotting to do that again because they're so desperate to kind of escape the shackles of their of being maids. And Genet based this on like a real thing that happened in France where two maids killed their mistress and her daughter, and then he was kind of exploring what it meant to be the maids in the situation rather than what it meant to be these kind of upper class people that are the kinds of people that have maids. Obviously, given that most people don't have hired help in this day and age on a regular basis or live in help, it's kind of a difficult thing to revive and make it relatable to an audience. But I think that they actually did a really good job. And it made me kind of mull on the reason that people do revivals at all and why revivals are kind of important in theatre. Mm-hmm. And the main reason, that the kind of main conclusion I came to was that actually it's really important to do revivals, and it doesn't always matter if they're not then totally kind of a perfect fit for a modern audience. And the reason that it's important is because it helps you to kind of like understand various like historical contexts of where the play has come from, and it helps you understand like the development of theatre and how we've got to this, you know, the modern new writing that you might see today. And also it just brings different stories to an audience that might not otherwise discover them if they're just play texts that are on a shelf.
Yeah.
And I think that Jamie Lloyd does a really good, like, what I really respect that theatre company for doing is bringing lots of different kinds of theatre to a young audience who might not otherwise discover it, and bringing in names like Uzo Aduba from Orange is the New Black, which is kind of a cult phenomenon with a younger generation, is going to bring people to see that show who might not otherwise consider going to the theatre at all.
It's very clever.
It's clever.
Like, wonderfully cast as well. I didn't realise that Vod was in it.
Yeah, she's absolutely amazing. Like, she's just incredible.
So insane. It's just mental.
And you're just watching these three incredible women do their craft on stage. Like, you're seeing them do their craft in exactly the way that you want to see it, and in the way that you don't get when you see a West End musical, for example. People who are in West End musicals are incredibly gifted and talented, they are, but it's just not the same kind of theatre craft that you see when you see a play like The Maids. And I just think it allowed them to just really explore that. So I was kind of having a think about like what we think of revivals, and if we've seen any particularly good revivals, or if we're coming up to seeing any revivals, and just was kind of having a think about like why that actually is important and why it's kind of a good thing that they're being done. So any thoughts?
Well, it's interesting hearing you say all of that, because I've always been sort of, my attitude has usually been, if you're going to put on a play, put on a new one. And if you're going to...
And obviously we do love new plays at Blackshaw.
But like that. But I think it's making me think of sort of the same reason that I didn't study much history at school, was because I had that slightly sniffy, it's already happened, why learn about it sort of attitude. Mm-hmm. Whereas that, as you say, sort of bringing back plays from sort of previous forgotten eras and decades, as a way of understanding the attitudes of those times, is an important thing to do, you know, to work out where these sort of attitudes and trends have come from in order to better understand where we are now.
I think in terms of like from a historical perspective, that is important to bring up, to show plays that were done in a period of time, and you know, trying to modernize that, maybe not modernizing it, maybe just still putting it on in the same sort of context. But the ideas behind the plays, the ideas that live inside them, can't just get lost in the past. Like, by doing revivals, you sort of bring those ideas back and make people think about them. And I think that's more important than just like the historicalness of. I mean, like we were saying with Shakespeare, isn't a revival.
Yeah, because it's just happening all the time.
Yeah.
Doesn't need reviving, nothing. Very much alive. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that I really kind of landed on is that the thing that you should be reviving is not necessarily the play exactly as it was written and exactly as it was performed the first time round. It's about the intention of the play. Like, what was Jenna trying to make the audience feel? What was he trying to have them take away at the end? And that's why the kind of swearing is an interesting addition, because the original play text from the 1940s obviously is not full of lots of kind of really pretty over the top at times swearing, but it makes sense in the modern context because that is a way to just add to the kind of like grotesquerie and the shock and awe that you're going to get from a modern audience from, you know, the use of certain words that you don't hear in everyday speech.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you that it's about putting a play on that makes the audience feel something. And I think what we've learned from Matt today is that he doesn't like the past.
Just future facing, that's okay.
I think it's a decision you've got to weigh up, because there's some plays that get forgotten because they were quashed or oppressed or were too ahead of their time and people of the time didn't understand them, and they're very worth bringing back. And then there are plays that are forgotten because they were boring or bad.
Yeah.
And obviously you take a risk when you decide to revive a play.
Yes, you do,
betting. The person who decides to revive that play clearly thinks there's something worth bringing to the audience, but sometimes there isn't.
Yeah.
It's the same with remakes of films.
Absolutely.
I mean, some remakes of films are awful.
Yeah.
And you go,
and unnecessary, which is worse.
And, why have you done this? Who paid for this?
Yeah.
How has this occurred? I was watching Charlotte's Web today. It was not as good as the cartoon I remember from when I was four.
And, you know, I was the final kind of thought that maybe we'll leave it on is that with art, with paintings, portraiture, whatever, that they exist. They just carry on existing in a museum or in a collection. And so you're still looking at paintings by Monet or by Cézanne or by people further and further back, by sculptors from ancient Greece. You're able to look and physically see those things in front of you because you can go to a museum and look at them because they still exist. But a play is fleeting and is only available really in the live moment. So you can't witness that from the past unless someone revives it and performs it for you.
Exactly.
In the same way that you can go and appreciate the old masters in art to inform your current practice as an artist. You can't really do that with theatre just by reading the play text. So, that's the parallel I'm going to draw.
That's really funny, actually, because the next thing that we're going to play is a interview that Helen Johnson has done with the writer of Black Shuck, Duncan Hands. Duncan says exactly what you just said in reference to when he was at school. He was like, his teacher was like, plays are boring. You can't just read a play. It's not the same.
You really can't.
But he, being the great writer that he is, figured out that he could actually like read them and visualize stuff as well. And he was saying that, you know, that's why kids don't like reading Shakespeare, because it's boring.
Don't
you want? It doesn't work on paper.
I'm always a great advocate for seeing it up on its feet, or at least
definitely
out loud.
Yeah.
So yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to play you this interview now and listen out for Duncan talking about that.
So is Black Shuck the first play that you've written?
It is the first original play. I did an adaptation previously of several Joseph Conrad stories.
Right.
And that's really interesting because there was a cheat on that. Basically, that was three stories woven together with a lot of doubling. And as a writer, that's much easier because you can say, right, this is this scene, I need to say that. And once I've said it, right, well, move on. Yeah, that's fine. We'll cut it. Once it gets boring, go on to the next bit. And with Black Shuck, it is just two people talking for a very long time. And as a writer, and as a relatively inexperienced writer, that's quite scary. It's you can't cheat. There's nowhere to hide, really. It's all in the words, and that, you know, sort of I put a bit more pressure on myself this time.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So because you're so involved in staging so many productions, does that mean you've got an idea of how it would look on its feet?
Yes, I mean it's always tricky, sort of envisaging that journey from words on a page to a three-dimensional people actually acting, but it's I think, and it's something I've very slowly learned, is to do that from a lighting designer's perspective, which is my main job, is listening to you read the script and you get the discuss ideas with the directors and with the actors and how it's going to go, and it never quite happens how you expect it to, and very often it's better. it's part of the sort of theatrical collaboration of different people coming in with different ideas, and it works better. I do remember when I was at school talking to my French teacher, and she was talking about reading French books, and it would be good if you did. I said, oh, don't bother reading plays because they're just boring to read. They should be. And she does have a point. The plays are actually, they're not meant to be read. It's the reason school kids hate Shakespeare is because if you read it, it's just noises. But if it's actually three-dimensional as a play, and I disagreed with this teacher because actually even at that point I was doing enough drama that I was able to visualise it sort of better than someone who wasn't involved in that process would actually be able to.
Yeah.
So if it's just words on a page, it's incredibly dull. But I do find that with all the different things, because I'm very much a jack of all trades theatrically, with all the different things that I do, each of them feeds into that process of being able to picture it as a finished product rather than just words on a page.
I do think with a lot of creative things, the more you know, the more you can contribute something new.
Especially this little mind up here, it clunks around slowly.
And then I set Vicky on you, who her day job is professional project management. Mm. So, if you need to get somebody to do something for Blackshaw, you send Vicky.
Get Vicky.
And she's like the nuclear option. It's just excellent.
Yes, and I think it's the lovely thing about Blackshaw is the different personalities and the similarities and the links that means there is a sort of unifying, sort of common, but there are the different personalities and interests and skills that do sort of make Blackshaw rather special.
I'd better ask you something more specific about your play now. I have Googled this, therefore I know the answer, but could you please tell our listeners the title of your play and then what on earth that thing is?
Yep, the title is Black Shuck, and it's a sort of legend and based in East Anglia, mostly around North Norfolk, of this demon dog, and it's the dog that became or is very similar. I'd be amazed if the Hound of the Baskervilles wasn't based on it, and also the Grimm in Harry Potter. It's an omen. If you see the dog, then it's an omen of death. But there are, of course, lots of, because it's a folk myth, there are all sorts of different variations on this myth, and some of it, there are actual stories of churches where the dog was seen, and there are also sort of stories of the dog being a good omen. And coming and helping, particularly sort of women in distress on their own, is one of the rather nice sort of variations of it.
Okay.
And that's the story. And the play is slightly tangentially about that. It was sort of the title is, it's more of a theme that's sort of dipped into every so often rather than the central feature of the show. The main line of the show is these two smugglers waiting for a shipment to come in on the North Norfolk marshes where they're waiting.
Right.
That's the great thing about writing this show is that the research was as much fun as anything else. There's finding out the stories, and there's and it's something that I've always loved is the atmosphere in those. It's one of the things I must tell Ellie and everyone that the photo I love, it perfectly sums up the atmosphere of that part of the coast. You know, it's not picture postcardy West Coast. It's bleak and unforgiving, but actually quite beautiful East Coast.
Yeah.
But I've been reading up on that now for as long as I've had this idea here, and reading up on the stories of Black Shucks, reading up about modern smuggling and the problems of drug use in North Norfolk. I mean, it's because it's out there, sort of on a peninsula. It feels like an island.
Yeah.
It's not a peninsula, but it feels very cut off from the rest of the world. And there's so much unemployment outside the holiday season that there are very serious problems with drug use in that part of the world. And reading up on that, and reading up on the historical sort of history of smuggling in that part of the world, that was brilliant. I mean, but my favourite story that come out of that was that in 1790 or so, the local landowners petitioned Parliament several times for help, because the whole population had gone over to smuggling. It was so much more lucrative than anything else that the local landowners were like, we can't get the harvest in. We can't. There's no one available to work for us because they're all just smuggling.
Oh my gosh. Vicky made a comparison to me with one of the Canterbury Tales.
Right.
Is that something that you had in your mind, or is that something that Vicky has applied?
No, it wasn't a conscious thing, but then that's rather fascinating, that there are almost these stories. There's no such thing as an original story. It all goes back to something.
I think it was just the shape, yeah. Because she said, oh, well, because in the Canterbury Tale, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, what? And I was like, so you've spoiled the Canterbury Tale and the play. Thank you very much. And she's like, I don't think it will matter with the play because it's not about what happens at the end. And I think that's true of a lot of plays, but I'm glad to hear it's true of yours.
Yeah. But then there's, that's the thing with storytelling is that they are all, there's a sort of through line and a way of telling a story that goes back to the Canterbury Tales, and you can't really replace it because there isn't a better way of doing it, you know.
Absolutely. So what did bring you to writing the play then?
It's an idea that had been rumbling around the back of my head, and funnily enough, I'd forgotten about it, but it's when I was 17 or so, was still at school and wrote up and was sort of vaguely thinking about sort of writing as a career, and wrote up a couple of scenes of a thing which is kind of similar. It's the same characters as have come in Black Shuck, and the same sort of premise. And I ought to find it and have a reread of it. And I showed it to a director that I knew, a professional director. And the reason I'd forgotten about this, the reason I was reminded of it, was that I'm working with her next week. So I was like, oh, that's quite a coincidence. Suddenly, but she gave me a few pointers about it and about writing generally and about what might happen with it.
Excellent.
So that was where the characters came from. And there was I've always been interested in that story of Black Shuck. What fascinates me about it is that first place where the story came from was smugglers in the heyday of smuggling in the late 18th century. They started this story basically just to keep people off the marshes. So they invented this dog and basically said, yeah, he lives out on the marshes, keep away from there or you'll die. and so it gave them the coastline to themselves. And that story had always fascinated me, and that was rumbling around in the back of my mind as well for a very long time. And so the two strands sort of came together, and this was about 4 years ago, and I thought, put that together and sort of did a bit of work on it and then put it to bed. And then you emailed me saying, oh yeah, that idea you mentioned, is that, and it sort of rumbled on in the back of my mind for a very long time, and now there's a script.
Yay!
And all sorts of photos and people getting involved, and it's
a
One of the things I love about theatre is the collaborative process. So obviously I have, when I sit down and write something, I have my idea of how I would do things.
Yeah.
And then I love giving that to a director and a lighting designer, a sound designer, a set designer and everyone else, and seeing how they do it.
Yeah.
And the way they do it is right. And it's lovely, that collaboration, how it then eventually arrives at the finished product.
Mm. Are you writing anything else?
At the moment, not theatre-wise. Oh. There is a little sort of book that, again, is rumbling around in the back of my mind. And when it'll come back in 10 years' time, it will have developed. But at the moment, there's sort of a little page of ideas. And one of the days, I'll sort of look at that. And most of them, I sort of go back and look at and think, no, that's rubbish. But occasionally you go back and that's a ridiculous idea. Of course that wouldn't work. You'd need a cast of 90 and no one would put it on. Don't be silly. But occasionally you look back at that and think, oh yeah, that idea does actually have legs. And you get sort of, you know, a little bit of inspiration and combine ideas and they do come together. But at the moment, just focusing on Black Shark, as I say, it being the first show I've written without sort of being able to fall back on trickery. I'm sort of putting everything into there.
Very good. Maybe your idea with your cast of 90 will end up as a one-man show.
You never know.
One of my personal mantras is better done than perfect. And I don't write, but I don't know if that fully applies. But there's this thing called NaNoWriMo in November, where you write a novel in a month.
Yeah.
I know Matt Boothman does that, or has done it. So if you haven't got any further with your ideas by November, we'll be calling you.
Well, I followed his by the tweets of his being so frustrated and thinking, oh God, I need to write a novel in a month. Oh, I haven't done enough words today, and being so frustrated with it. So maybe that's not the way to do it. But you're absolutely right. But that's why, I mean, the Blackshaw sort of new writing nights are so good, because you can just try out ideas and say, oh, right, well, that works, that doesn't, that works, this is good, you know, that, and you can do it on a very small scale, and just to try things, and it'll either steer where it goes, or you'll sort of look at it and think, I'm not sure about that idea. But normally, if it gets to that stage, it's an idea that's made it past the internal filters, so at least it's, you know, it's got legs, but, you know, and if you're trying something really new, then you can think, oh, well, that works, that doesn't. Yeah. So it's perfect for that.
Yeah, well, I think Blackshaw are quite nurturing. That's one of the things I like about them.
Mm. Yeah.
So I feel like we've barely talked about the play.
No.
But then I don't want to talk too much about what it's about. One of the things that we've had various interesting discussions about is potentially trying to define by genre. Because it sort of doesn't fit.
No, it doesn't fit into one, certainly.
Do you have any thoughts about that? How would you describe?
Oh, it's tricky. Well, I kind of started off writing it as a sort of modern gothic horror. And then there were a couple of jokes that occurred. So, all right, we'll start off with a funny gothic horror. And then, well, there's a bit of a drama, and there's actually the human story there is quite interesting as well. So it's a bit of a psychological thriller.
Yeah.
But I like that. I like not being able to pigeonhole things, you know, and it's all of the great plays. You think sort of Pinter and Chekhov are incredibly funny. They're thought of as being serious. But the things that make them move is the jokes. The fact that it starts off very, very funny, and towards the final act, the final denouement, that's why it hits you so hard, is that because it's been so funny, when it gets moving, it's all the more moving.
Yeah.
And that's what sort of theatre, it's what all sort of narrative art should be.
Yeah.
It should make you laugh and make you cry and make you think and all of those. If it just makes you cry or just makes you laugh, it's a bit dull, really.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Other than when we're doing Alice in Wonderland for children. In which case, we'll stick with not making them cry.
It's probably a bad idea if you do.
Unless they're crying because it's finished.
Yes.
I think with kids' theatre, that's probably
that one,
the goal.
You're all right. Yeah.
I'm sure we're going to get all of those things out of you in Black Shuck. And hopefully, it sounds like you're going to be around doing the run so I can speak to you there about things.
Yep.
Thank you very much for your long time. That's great.
It's odd. I'm not thought of as chatty, but as soon as I sort of start, I do go. I've been my whole life a bit, oh yeah, he's the quiet one. But, I start off talking about things that I find interesting. And can actually talk for quite a long time. Surprise myself.
Helen Johnson has a really good ability to be able to make people talk. That's what Duncan was just saying towards the end of that interview. He was saying, I'm surprised at how long I've spoken to you for. So well done, Helen, on getting all of the information out of Duncan Hands. Duncan is the writer of Black Shuck. Black Shuck is coming up on the 11th to the 19th of May as a part of WAF. We are putting it on at the Bedford in Balham, so come down. We'll be there. Vicky is planning on coming. I'll be there a few nights.
Yeah, so, yeah, I think it's one of those things where I'll say I'll only be there like once or twice, but I will be there.
We'll be there every night. Yeah. That's what will happen. It's going to be fun. Also, the Bedford's great. And it's an hour long.
It's come perfect.
Come for the theatre, stay for the pub.
Yeah.
That's what I say about theatre.
This is the great thing about Fringe Theatre is when it's just an hour, you can see something incredible, have a great time, and still leave by like 9 p.m.
Yeah. Or feel like stay and have longer in
or
the pub.
Or stay and have longer in the pub. So either way, you're a winner.
Yeah. It is great, and we are very excited about it. Also, we've been talking about new writing a little bit on this show. If you are a person who writes, then you've got a deadline on the 29th of April, which is this coming Friday, to get your submissions in for our May New Writing Night, which is on the 17th.
Yeah, and that is any kind of writing. It doesn't have to be plays. It can be fiction or poetry. Maybe you've got some stand-up comedy you want to try out. Like anything, as long as it's writing and it's new. Yep. Those are the only conditions. Everything else is fair game. Send it in to us on the by the 29th, and you can find all the information at blackshawonline.com/NWN.
Yes. All of the information is on our website. We're blackshawonline.com. You guys are going to see loads of theatre.
So much theatre is happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm seeing Les Blancs at the National this week.
Sweet. That'll be good.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds good.
I don't really either.
I think that's going to be good.
What are you seeing, Vix?
I'm seeing the absolutely incredible, I'm so excited about it, I might cry, James Norton in Bug. Wednesday afternoon. Me and Ellie are having the afternoon off work to go to the theatre. I'm so excited. It's going to be luxurious.
That sounds beautiful. I hope it's... Is it pop-up, did you say?
Yeah, there's this pop-up theatre they've done on Charing Cross Road called Charing Cross 111. So...
Is that outside? Pop-up screams outside.
No, I think it's... It'll be like they've taken something that's kind of like a studio space and turned it into a studio space somehow. I kind of love seeing theatres like... That's why I love the Edinburgh Fringe, because they can literally turn anything into a theatre space, and that's a... Always nice to be reassured that you can turn any kind of venue into a space where you can do some theatre.
Yeah. Also, guys, don't forget that we are a podcast, and you can subscribe to our podcast. We are the Blackshaw Arts Hour. If you want to go and Google us, then we'll come up, and we're also on iTunes. So hit subscribe, and then we are just on your thing.
There's all kinds of treats. All kinds of treats on there, including all of the episodes of Great Expectations, if you missed it, which you can listen to. And also, last episode, there's an absolutely incredible interview with Tom Weston Jones of Dickensian fame, which Ellie did a great job of interviewing him for. So do go check that out if you haven't listened already.
We have lots of bonus content all the time as well. There'll be nice little cast interviews, I think, from Black Shuck, and lots of little bonus stuff that we can't squeeze into the hour that we have on a Sunday. Speaking of an hour, we're done. We're finished.
We're there. Done. Done deal. Let's go home.
Don't get too excited, Vicky. Come on. This is a nice experience.
No, it was. I'm just sad that it's over
for
another fortnight.
Okay. So we're going home, but you all should keep listening. The cheese board is coming up next. I've been instructed to warn you to brace your ears for the cheese board.
Mysterious. I'm going to tune in on my way home.
I'm slightly scared by that. But that's it. That's the end of the show. We'll be with you in a fortnight's time. Thank you to my co-hosts. And bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.